You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We head to the northeastern United States to catch up with CHAMP researcher and investigator Katie Elizabeth. Katie has had a lot going on since we last spoke, from some tantalising new data, sonar hits, television appearances, and her plans for this year. It's always a pleasure catching up with Katie. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. You can also visit our website, mysteriesandmonsters.com, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Time to get our life jackets on, listeners, as we head on and under the surface of Lake Champlain in the company of Katie Elizabeth. We head back to the northeastern United States to catch up with our old friend Katie Elizabeth. Katie has continued to cement her reputation as the leading researcher on whatever lurks in Lake Champlain, and has continued to search for more evidence of CHAMP. Katie, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back on the show.
It's always nice speaking to you. As we were joking before we started properly, I always feel like I've spoken to you fairly recently, but we haven't spoken for nearly 2 years, Katie. So I'm terribly sorry I've been so poor in inviting you back.
Well, I'm not any better because I've been so busy with projects and things. And I'm like, you know, I see like your little green light on Facebook, and I'm like, I got to get a hold of Paul and say hi. I apologize to you. I'm like, so sorry. I haven't kept in touch much or anything. It's just been crazy on my end. So don't feel bad. I was doing the same thing.
Well, since we last spoke, I'm not really sure what else you could have done to fill your time, Katie, with everything else that you've had going on in your life. So it's been quite an incredible time, because the last time we'd spoken, you just upgraded your boat with the marvellous Kelpie 2 now, and you were organising the trips out and things, and you were planning on what was going to be coming up for the following year. And then last year just seems to have been an amazing mixture of film, evidence, moving around, looking for other creatures all over the place. You've just thought, I'll tell you what I need to do. I need to fill up more hours in my day, more times of the year.
That's for sure. And like I said before, I'm always, my brain doesn't stop. I'm always thinking of new adventures to go on. I mean, outside of CHAMP too. And I'm like, I really need to just slow down my brain and kind of take it easy. I take too many things on at once, and then I tend to have some like production projects that I haven't finished yet, so I'm trying to get everything done at once, and it's like, it's not easy.
Well, I suppose first of all, congratulations should be in order, because you were awarded several prizes at the International 14 Film Festival last year for your film, Katie. Were you humbled, surprised, secretly thought, yeah, I deserve those awards, give them to me now?
I was very humbled, and I was very surprised, because I've never had the opportunity to enter any of my production material into a film festival. So when I was asked, like, do you want to enter? And, like, I happened to see it online, and I do know Tim Wittard, so I've mm-hmm. spoken with him, and he's like, you really should enter your stuff. And I was like, okay, all right. I didn't think anything would really happen. Because I know there was so many great pieces that were, you know, nominees and stuff, and I was like, oh, God, you know, I'm up against a lot of great stuff. So I was really humbled and very, very surprised when I got 4 gold awards. I was like, holy moly, that's really good for my first time. So I was really, really grateful for that opportunity. And it's got my creative flow going with coming up with new ideas for productions. I am still working on Lady of the Lake, The Search for Champ. It was a trailer that I had entered the 14 Film Festival. And I'm going to give it a little bit more time because I do have a lot of material to make the documentary. But I wanted to include a little bit more on the new research vessel because I had a lot of footage from my first boat, Kelpie. The smaller boat. So I'm like, oh gosh. And I only got to film so much of the new research vessel. So I'm like, maybe I should give it a little bit more time. So I think that's what I'm going to do. Cause sometimes, as they say, haste makes waste. So I want this to come out really good. And plus on top of it, we did get amazing sonar video in September of 2022. So I want to include that. I'm glad that I didn't finish it. Cause that wouldn't have been in there if I did.
So for anybody that's not seen the trailer, Katie, give them a taste of what the documentary film's about and what you're trying to focus on and promote in regards to releasing it.
Okay, so my documentary is called Lady of the Lake, The Search for Champ, and it basically starts out from when I'm a child. And what got me into Champ was I saw the famous Mancy photo that was taken in 1977 of the head and neck. And in the trailer... the full trailer. Now, the short is the one that got in the 14 Film Festival, not the whole trailer, which kind of, I don't know, I had trouble uploading. It was a pain in the butt. I'll have to I'll have to put that back on YouTube and stuff, the full trailer. But it basically starts out with the Sandra Mancy photo that I saw on Unsolved Mysteries. And then it goes into where I'm talking to my mom on the phone and she was giving me a little bit of a pep talk. And she says, don't ever give up. You're going to do this. You're going to get evidence. And then it shows me slamming the cover of my Pelican case, which has a lot of my equipment in it. And when that happens, the music starts and it shows me on the research vessel going down the lake and, you know, tells about my goal to conservation towards these animals, as well as the research. And it's I'll definitely, I mean, if you look up Lady of the Lake, The Search for Champ on YouTube, you'll be able to see the trailer on there for anybody that's interested. So that's kind of just the quick synopsis of what the trailer is about and what the documentary is about. And the documentary, too. It's also going to include a lot of eyewitness interviews, a lot of people that I've made friends with during my search for Champ and their experiences on their sightings. And it's going to show different tactics in the research, the nighttime investigations that I go out in the marsh systems looking for tapetum lucidum, which is eye shine, looking for any type of drag marks or prints, because there have been prints found in these marsh systems around Lake Champlain. So it's kind of a mix of eyewitness reports as well as my field research that I've been doing for more than a decade now.
I mean, it is amazing, really, because obviously you were one of the first people I ever had on the show 4 years ago now, Katie, which seems like yesterday sometimes when I think about it. And so I've been really interested in watching your reputation grow and your research continue to develop. But I've always been impressed by the fact, because often when we talk about strange creatures, Katie, a lot of it is more about the discovery and the fame that would come with such a thing. Whereas you've always had a big belief in conservation and protection. You've been very vocal, publicising, wanting to get it, whatever this creature is, to get it protected, which you've managed to do several years ago. You've continued to try and raise awareness, but you've also looked at the ecological situation there and the problems with the sewage and the debris that's coming into the area as well. So you are probably one of the few cryptozoologists who seems to be looking at the big picture rather than just the creature.
Well, thank you for that. And, you know, some people don't realize, like when they first join my Facebook or go on my website, at first people are thinking, oh, this person is trying to just prove and try to get famous from it or whatever. And there was someone that had put a little thing out podcast not too long ago, talking about the CHAMP investigators over the years during this whole study, people way before me as well. And, oh, they're just looking for fame and fortune and this and that. But yet they're the ones trying to get on every TV show and then nobody takes them on. So they get mad when people are. You know, I mean, like, that's the reality of it. I mean, you wouldn't believe the it's not as bad as the Bigfoot world, because the lake monster world's only so big. But you get these people that will say things like that. And I'm like, where? And like, well, we need someone who's scientific minded. And the person saying all this just happened to write a book about CHAMP, but never really went out to investigate or do any scientific work, any type of biological work on Lake Champlain. So it's like, who is this person to say that? You know, it's just, it's silly. And it's their opinion. And I, you know, that's fine. That's their opinion. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. But, you know, to go on and say that there's nothing scientifically done, there hasn't been anything really found, that's baloney, because all of the data that I've collected, the video, the echolocation, and the sonar, has all been analyzed by bioacousticians, sonar experts, video analysts, and stated authentic. Mm-hmm. So for someone to say all that is just hogwash, and they're just spewing things out of their mouth that's not the truth. So, I mean, that's just my opinion. I'm trying to be proper about what I'm saying, because if it was me on a day where we're sitting at the pub, I'd just be like, well, this person's this. You know, if I could really let loose. But it's just, I mean, that's the thing. And they never, a lot of the Bigfoot people that do Bigfoot research, there might be a couple that actually look at the big picture on conservation of, you know, the Bigfoot species or the ecology of the forest. You know, if they have a conference for Bigfoot, everything goes into somebody's pocket. And I know you have to make money to run an event. It's a very expensive endeavor to do. But you never see anything that says, hey, we're going to put proceeds towards conservation of the redwoods in California, or let's plant every so much that we make, we will plant a tree. I mean, why can't people think of that stuff? It doesn't make any sense to me. We have to protect our Mother Earth and whatever's here, because obviously, whether it's the CHAMP animals, which I believe is pretty much the same thing as Nessie and other lake creatures around the world, if they're not the same, they're most likely related with descriptions. But and the same thing with Bigfoot. I mean, you got to think of that big picture of they're not in every lake. Bigfoots are not in every single forest. Probably, I know there's a lot of Bigfoot reports all over the United States, but you know, they're probably in danger, especially the lake creatures. I think that they're more in danger than the Bigfoot creatures are. So, I mean, with that thought, people just don't get it. I guess because I'm a nature person and I truly enjoy nature and I see so much destruction. I have very open mind to things and open eyes. I mean, I notice things that people are like, how did you notice that? So I'm very aware of my surroundings and all that, and the effects of us humans to this planet, I think is the biggest thing that I'm concerned about for the CHAMP animals and their protection and the protection of Lake Champlain.
Mm. I think as well, as you mentioned there in regards to Bigfoot, what's gone on in recent years in California with the amount of wildfires that have broken out, it is staggering sometimes that never seemed to come into it. And, you know, I'm certainly not saying that I know what every Bigfoot organization are doing. I'm not very sure that many people look at it at that whole picture that, you know, protecting the habitat. I know obviously a lot of them are in national forests, Katie, and so they come under the government protection and jurisdiction in that regard. But also, if we are to believe what people tell us, they're all over the place in certain other states around. And some of them don't have those protections that other famous locations have. So it's one of those questions that we need to ponder about. When you work in cryptozoology, we are looking for unknown animals. So
essentially, as you say there, for me, it needs to go hand in hand in general conservation, because if you don't protect the ecology, there won't be anything left to look for anyway. Regardless, it's two sides of the same coin, is it not?
I absolutely agree with that. And like to the common person that doesn't really know much about cryptozoology, that, like, for instance, someone that has kind of laughed about the idea of CHAMP, you know, the general consensus about CHAMP is that they're this 100-foot-long monster. I hate the word, even though it's on your podcast title, but you got to generalize it for everybody. And it sounds cool. It sounds cool. I'm going to get kicked off of this, aren't I?
No, you've got a long way to go to match some of the things I like to cut out, Katie. You're all right.
But when people hear the word monster, they're like, oh, they think of like this 100-foot-long thing that's going to eat people. And it's the general fear. The fear of the unknown is, you know, it scares people, I think. And that's another reason why you have people like, oh, that's baloney. But to think like there's 100-foot-long monsters in Lake Champlain, even though it's a massive body of water, that's a big animal, 100 feet long. And the average size is 15 to 30, 35 feet is probably the largest specimen I've heard of in the lake. One of the CHAMP animals that I got on my first sonar, the still images, I'd estimate that one, I named her Elsie. I estimate she's probably about 35 feet long. That is a big, big one. And what's really interesting in that area, there has been one seen that is very, very large, and I think it may be her. So I think throughout the lake, there are pairs of these animals. I believe that they group in pairs of two or more. They might be like breeding. I think they're breeding pairs. So you get the male and the female, and then another breeding pair. They have certain times a year that they breed. I think it might be probably end of August. Where there's like multiple sightings, which could make someone think they're seeing a 100-foot-long creature, but there's one behind the other.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like a very, very large one very, very large animal. So, I mean, with the whole thing like that, people think, well, that's stupid that someone wrote a protection law because they don't exist. Well, you know, it's I mean, I have enough data to show that there is something there. It's not like I'm just pulling it out of a hat. And, you know, you can't ignore the hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of eyewitnesses that have seen these creatures since the Native American times.
Mm. Well, this is often the thing when it comes to all kinds of strange creatures sighted. It seems that people will cherry pick certain strands or histories to certain creatures and say, oh, well, nobody mentioned it in the newspapers till 1900, so therefore everything else before that's nonsense, as though they expect people to have had newspapers 600 years ago, Katie, and everybody wrote stories down or kept diaries. You know, it's well established that a lot of cultures used oral storytelling to keep their histories alive around the world, not just in the United States and North American continent. It was everywhere else. So it seems churlish, you know, once again, when people say, oh, well, Bigfoot only started being reported in 1958. And you're like, do you even bother looking at historical documents? And it's the same, like you say, because wherever you go, where there are sightings of strange creatures and there are other lake creatures seen in other states and into Canada, where when you dig about and have a look at it, there's oral traditions of these creatures going back centuries. These are not modern inventions.
And that's the thing that gets me when, you know, there's actually a sign on the lake that they had put up. I don't know how much it cost them, but I mean, someone actually stole it. And I was like, well, it's probably not a bad thing because it's misinformation, but, but it was this 100 CHAMP is like 135 feet long and been seen since the 1800s. And I'm like, where the hell did you get your information from? It's like, you know, you're supposed to be spreading like awareness of, I mean, even if they're going to just do it as just a legend aspect, at least know what to put on a sign. You know, going back to the Native Americans, there were stories of the horned serpents in Lake Champlain And when they crossed the lake, they would throw offerings of tobacco to allow them a safe passage. And that is a fact. So it's like they don't go by the true historical accounts. And that was before the newspapers, obviously. But, you know, the other thing, too, about reports of whether it's Bigfoot or Nessie or Champ is that up until those points, I mean, you got to think about it, too. How many reports have not been put forth? You know, people that are afraid of ridicule. So say 1910, someone had a sighting and had the guts to go out in public and say, hey, this is what I saw. And then all of a sudden you're going to have a rash of sightings around there because people are actually really looking, too. You know, they're looking out the lake and saying, hey, I'm going to keep an eye out for what so-and-so next door saw or whatever. You know, they're more aware of it. And not just that, a lot of people during that time, unless one person would speak up, they wouldn't say a damn thing.
Yeah.
So I think it's like, hey, you saw that? Oh, I saw that too. And then it's a big reaction. And then, oh, only the 1800s had a huge amount of sightings. Well, maybe that's why it was an influence and a good influence for people to not be afraid of ridicule of what they saw.
Mm. Have you continued to see interest from television programs and documentary makers? Because I think the last time we'd spoke, you just turned up on Josh Gates's Expedition X, terrorizing Phil and Jessica and taking them out at night on there. And there were some strange things going on and weird noises being heard. Katie, is it still something that you get a lot of interest for? Because as I said in your introduction, for me, you've become synonymous with Champ. Whatever's there, you're the first, whenever anybody mentions Champ or Lake Champlain, you're the first person I think of now.
Yeah, I mean, I did that show and I've had a couple of interests coming in. I think COVID kind of messed things up. Hmm. It was like I was getting production companies left and right and it was going crazy and it was a lot of work. And then finally, like COVID hit. And I did film for another program called Mysteries Decoded on the CW network. I did that, which was okay. I mean, there was one part with a biologist where they had cut out where she saw my sonar of them swimming underneath the boat. And that was the part where she said, oh, I don't know what that is. I have no idea. Well, of course, they cut that out. They only put in the part where of her saying, well, those things in the bottom, they're probably logs. And I was kind of upset with that because I was like, I was told that, you know, she saw that picture of them under the boat and she was like, oh, well, why the heck wouldn't they always have to like keep in some sort of skepticism, I guess, in some of these programs. And, you know, they cut and they edit so many things out and you just never know how the heck it's going to come out. So it just it came out. Otherwise, it was great. I really had a good time filming, but that was during COVID. And I had to take, even with Josh Gates' show, I had to take the COVID test, spit in the tube and all this nonsense, you know, to make sure I didn't have COVID and they didn't have COVID. And because they came all the way from California. So it was, it was a busy time. And then all of a sudden it just kind of went boof. And I haven't had a ton of interest since. I mean, I was on the German news, which was a big surprise because I have a lot of relatives in Germany and they're like, you were on television. I'm like, what? So.
Well, I mean, I always am interested when Josh Gates delves into the world of the strange. And I do like Expedition X. I know there's been a couple of shows where things have been a bit, I'm not sure about that. So as with anything, Katie, I think anybody that's had any sort of brush with television is aware of what you do doesn't necessarily turn up on TV. So often it can give a slant that you're not aware of or whatever.
Yeah.
But like you say about the biologists kind of saying, oh, well, I think they're logs. I mean, one of the things you tend to do as well is when you get a response or a reading on your instrumentation, you will go back to make sure that that isn't a log or just some debris or whatever. Because I know there's a famous sonar reading you got a few years ago, Katie, which showed was it a couple of thing creatures or shapes at the bottom of the lake? And then when you went back a few weeks later, they weren't there anymore.
Yes. Yeah, that's the part that they had left out in the show, which I was like so mad about. And, you know, I went back to the location. Those logs were gone. And then further up the lake is when I got them swimming under my boat and diving down. You can see the stream of bubbles where the one in the front, it was giving off bubbles going down and an air bubble coming out of its mouth. So you can see the two shapes underneath the boat swimming. So I'm like, well, isn't it amazing? I didn't know logs could swim. So, I mean, and that's the part where she was like, oh, I don't know what that is. And I do notice with her, she's not a bad skeptic. She's okay. I don't dislike the woman. You know, she's not terrible where she's like, oh, this is stupid, or there's definitely not something in the lake. She'll just say, I think it's highly unlikely. But, you know, to me, what people say that don't believe or whatever, that's okay to me because they've never seen it firsthand. So it doesn't bother me. And over the years, I've gotten really thick skin. And it's like, I at the beginning, like I would have like a ton of people quite a few at like different events that I would go to that would walk by and just laugh about it. But the funny thing is, like, with all the data that I've collected now, I met up with the same people and they're like, wow, you're really impressing me. This is quite something, because I didn't really believe anything was there. And I mean, there was one woman that I had spoken to and she was just like, she's kind of rude to me. And she's like, well, I fished the lake. And I'm like, I'm an angler as well. I've been fishing since I was 7 years old. So I fish as well. And I've never seen anything. She just gave me a really hard time. And I mean, anybody else would have been like telling her off, but I just laughed, you know, and I said, well, someday maybe you'll see something. Well, the next year I have my Champ Fest event. She shows up and I kind of had forgotten about it was her. And I'm looking at her, I'm like, why does she look familiar to me? And then she's like, hey, and she sits there and she's like bowing her head down. I'm like, what's the matter? And she's like, I just wanted to apologize for being such a jerk to you last year. And I said, oh, don't worry about it. I said, okay, I remember who you are now. And then she says, you know why? Because I was out on my boat fishing. It was like 5 o'clock in the morning and I freaking saw a head and neck come up, and she starts crying, like really crying. And I'm like, I said, see, I freaking told you. And she was like, she gave me a hug. She was, I'll never doubt anything you say to me again, ever, ever. And just like I said, it's amazing. And there was another guy that had a sighting over in Arnold's Bay, where there's been a lot of reports. And he was on the boat with one of his workers that works on his cow farm, a guy's from Mexico. And they're just sitting there and chilling out. It was like a really hot day. And they saw something like breach the surface. And then they looked over the side of the boat and it went underneath the boat. And they were like, oh, and he swims across the lake at that point and back. And I used to tell him, Hans, he's a Dutch guy. I'm like, Hans, and he wears a Speedo. And I'm just like, oh, Hans, put some more clothes on, please. You know, I was just like, oh, my God. I said, for Christmas, I'm going to get him some board shorts, because that Speedo is just, my eyes will never unsee what I saw. So so he goes across the lake and he can swim the whole width, which is, it's narrow down that end, but still, I think it's like probably like a mile or so, but still, that's a ways.
Yeah.
And I used to say to him, Hans, you better be careful. Oh, there ain't nothing in here. There ain't nothing in here. And then after that, I went down to the lake and I saw him walking around, because someone had told me he had a sighting. And I said, I'm not going to say anything. He comes up to me, he goes, oh man, you're going to love it. I said, I already heard. I said, you saw Champ, huh? And he goes, oh my God, I'll never doubt you again. I'm sorry, I used to pick on you all the time. I'm like, it's okay. So it's amazing. It's amazing how you run into people like that have been proven wrong. You know, it's awesome to me, because it's like, there you go. Now you know that I wasn't full of crap. So there it is.
I suppose as well, Katie, they're the best people you can get on your side, really, because they're the people that doubt you or think you're misinterpreting things, or you know, often people say, oh, well, what do you know? You know, I'm sure we're very aware of this. In any walk of life, people will always look down on new people or certain people will have an opinion about someone's veracity of their information based on how they look or whatever. I'm always impressed when somebody who doubts something comes and says, I'm really sorry, I've seen something that's changed my life. So is it one of those things that when you're doing these champ festivals and meetings and you've got your online presence, are you still getting a steady stream of people? Or, as can often be the case, especially here in the UK, people go, oh, nobody's seen Nessie for 3 months. And then all of a sudden you get five very dubious sightings in about a week. And then she's back then. Nessie's okay. She's come back from wherever she's been. Is that the same kind of thing with Champ, or is it more of a just a steady, gentle bubbling along of reports?
I do seem to see a pattern with the sightings or people reporting the sightings, which a lot of people don't. I mean, you think about how many people that really don't because they're just afraid of ridicule and stuff, but it's kind of the same. I mean, sometimes I'll get reports like 10, 20 years later, it's like, whoa, it took all this time for someone to say something, you know? So and then sometimes, like, I think it was 2014, I had quite a few reports during that summer when I was getting the echolocation and I had gotten the video of Champ Animal Crossing Button Bay. So that was a really hot time in the Champ timeline. And that was interesting. So it just seems to be like a weird kind of a sporadic pattern. It's not really a steady pattern. And you know, I've tried to, like, say if someone said they had a sighting in 2014, they don't tell me until now, then I add it to the database for that year, and then I can get even more of a better idea and that of a pattern, you know. But I mean, usually the sightings, the best times is July, August, September. Once October hits, it seems like everything just plummets. And I think it's because these animals are ectothermic. So the water temperature is plummeting at that point and getting colder. So they're, you know, starting to slow down. That's my theory. I'm not saying that I know exactly what they are. That's just my theory on the morphology. I've gotten the sonar. The sighting reports have been sunbathing on the shoreline. Mammals do sunbathe, our pinnipeds as well. They do that, but the thing is, you would see them all the time coming up for air if they were some type of whale, a cetacean, or a pinniped.
Well, I suppose one of the defenses of that as well is that, as I mentioned Loch Ness, Katie, and people go on about how big that place is. I mean, Champlain is enormous, absolutely enormous, and with the greatest of respect, not anyone is going to be able to cover such a vast expanse of water at any point, really. You can only deal with the bit you're in, with the greatest of respect. And it's not populated all the way around. I would imagine it's not the most heavily trafficked body of water in the US either, Katie. So I'm one of those people that I'm surprised there are as many reports of something in a body of water that big, because it's massive.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, the thing is with a lot of the sightings, aren't not necessarily in the deep water. A lot of people think, oh, we got to get a submarine, which would be, if I ever win the lottery, I'd love to get a 2-man sub. I'd be deathly afraid I wouldn't be able to get back up to the surface again. That's the only thing I'd worry about. But, you know, most of the sightings are in quite shallow water, like 65 feet or less. So I think the reason for that in those areas is a concentration of marine life. So you've got a lot of fish congregating around different islands. There's been a lot of sightings, ledges. So if you look at the bathymetric of Lake Champlain and you look at where the rivers come out, the mouths of the rivers, those are other great places where there's been sightings. And I believe really the only reason why we're probably seeing them at the surface is they're feeding. They're going after the fish at the surface. And during when the sun's coming up, you know, dusk and dawn, those are the best times to have a sighting. And midday when the sun's at its peak, they could be coming up to get vitamin D from the sun as well, kind of basking and whatnot. So those are the places to really look if you're doing an investigation, the mouths of the rivers, the ledges. Look at the bathymetric maps and see like say if it's 64 feet in Button Bay, and then all of a sudden you have 11 feet in Button Bay right next to it, you know that there's a mound. Matter of fact, in Button Bay, there is a mound. They call, the locals call it the haystack, and they call it that because everybody has hay fields in that area because it's so rural. So it must have been probably a farmer said, hey, we got to go out to the haystack and catch some perch, you know? So that's what they call it, the haystack. And there's been a lot of sightings out near that haystack. And I put the camera down and I've seen tons and tons of perch following my underwater camera with the LED light, which attracts them. Mm. So there is an abundance of perch. The lake also has smelt, but they're not as common as they used to be. They've kind of, what has happened, there's a thing called an alewife, which is a type of fish that is invasive that has gotten into Lake Champlain, and they've been killing off a lot of the smelt, the native population of smelt. So, you know, the smelt are in there, but they're down deep. And when I got my sonar in 2019, there was one frame. I didn't show everybody that frame. It is interesting. I will have to post it, but you can actually see this huge school of fish spreading out, and then the two squiggly shapes appear. And I was like, holy crap. So they're chasing the fish to the surface is what they were doing. So that was really amazing to see. And I'll tell you what, there is a lot of bait fish in the lake, especially the areas where there's been sightings. Because last year over near Westport, New York, which isn't terribly far, I don't ever tell anybody where I got my sonar stuff. I try to keep it a secret, but out of the protection aspect. But over in Westport, New York, which is not far from where I got the sonar stuff, there is a huge amount of bait fish. I mean, one particular day I had gotten, oh my God, I would say it was probably, 40 to 50 feet wide of a bait ball of bait fish.
Mm.
It was big. It was really big. It reminded me of like when you watch like on the Discovery Channel and they show like sardines when they're schooling in a circle and they're going around and around and around. And then you see like a baleen whale come into the view and then all of a sudden they scoop them up with their mouth. That's what it reminded me of, that large of an area of bait fish. And I was like, holy cow, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it because I've never seen that many bait fish in one area. And I've been keeping a study on the specific area where I've gotten the sonar, and that's what I'm finding. There's a lot of ledges, there's a lot of bait fish and also perch, a lot of like really easy for them to eat fish. You know, it's not like there's big people think they feed on 7 foot long sturgeon, or which is like the largest specimen that's ever been found. Lake Champlain is 7 feet. I mean, they might, but their head's only so big. I mean, they could probably take a chunk out of one, but it would be easier for them to be going after bait fish or small perch. So to fit in their mouth.
Absolutely. Well, you only have to look at how big whales are and what they eat, Katie, to think, well, why is it going to start going after big things? It's just going to get loads of little things, surely.
Oh, yeah. And you know, you look at it like the with the baleen and stuff, and they're going and scooping up all this water and they're getting all the plankton out of the water. So I mean, they could be feeding on the weeds and all of that stuff that's in Lake Champlain, the vegetation. I think they're opportunistic. I think they pretty much eat whatever they can get their mouth on, to be honest.
Has there been any kind of thoughts in regards to whatever these creatures are, that they're urohilene organisms, that they can spend time in fresh and salt water? You know, because people often seem to presume that creatures in the water can only either exist in fresh or salt, which I often find very surprising, because you only have to think of salmon to see that there are creatures out there that can be very happy in both fresh and salt water. I mean, there are other, I think, is there a fish called the molly that likes to show off because it can do brackish, salt and fresh, which is just, which for me, I think is just showing off that in the world of the fish, that's just going, hey, think you're clever, look at me.
Yeah, I wear many hats. Well, you know, if you think about it, you have bull sharks and they are totally capable of going in brackish and fresh water. I mean, there's been reports, I'm trying to think exactly where I've heard some reports. I think there was even, trying to think. I think there was even something about the Hudson River in New York where a bull shark was seen coming through. So that's really interesting. I mean, Lake Champlain is connected to the sea still, but it's indirectly. You know, you've got locks and you have the St. Lawrence Seaway and all of that. So you've got locks in between. So, I mean, it's indirectly connected. But these animals, I mean, you never know. There could be some kind of tunnels that go out to the ocean. Who the heck knows? I mean, I think it's a possibility because they're. It's not my theory, but I think it's a possibility. I'm open to it. There are some pretty interesting reports from a lake called Lake Willoughby in the Northeast Kingdom, they call it, in Vermont. And up towards that area, you also have Lake Memphremagog, which another creature that's been seen there is called Memphrey. And Memphrey and Champ sightings are very, very similar. Same coloring, same size, same horse-like head with the horn like protuberances on top of the head. So I believe they're the same species. And it makes kind of sense geographically of, you know, being in the same area, basically. So who knows when the glaciers pulled through this area, what was left? You know, I mean, that's, I think, what we're dealing with going all the way back to that time when the glaciers cut through. So with Lake Willoughby near Lake Memphremagog, what's really interesting is there was a report of there's been a few reports of sightings, of course, not a ton, though, and they're really random. And because Lake Willoughby is only 5 feet long, but it's 375 feet deep. So it's like a big giant crater, pretty much, is what it's like, a big gouge from the glaciers. But what's interesting about that lake during the 1800s, there was a time where it completely froze over and they had horses going across bringing ice blocks. Because back then we didn't have normal refrigeration. We had to use ice blocks and an ice box. So they were bringing those blocks across and the horses broke through the ice and drowned. And what was really amazing was 2 weeks later down the road is Crystal Lake. They found those horses in Crystal Lake.
Wow.
So it makes you wonder what the heck is under there, like for a cave system, a tunnel or whatever. And what's really interesting in looking at the bathymetric of Lake Willoughby is I had found on a map, there's this, I'm not sure how big the hole is. I'd have to like do some measurements and all that on the map itself. But looking at that bathymetric, it's like this really deep, the deepest hole in the whole lake that they don't know how deep it is. So I'm wondering, and it's on that, north side of Lake Willoughby, which Crystal Lake, I think, is west of that, northwest. So I think there might be some sort of tunnel going into Crystal Lake. So, I mean, if there's that kind of geographical stuff going on in that area, who's to say with Lake Champlain there's not some kind of crazy tunnels going into, the St. Lawrence Seaway or whatever. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you only have to look at Florida. Rather closer to your current location, Katie, because you just have to look at what's going on there. I've seen numerous programs about these incredible underwater tunnel systems that are opening up because the state's getting wetter and so the ground's melting.
And yes.
People are just going down these boreholes and just popping up 200 feet away. I saw one where they were swimming under a golf course. Because the ground's just been eroded by the rain and the hurricanes coming in, that you've now got all this kind of underground catacombs full of water. And I know you were mentioning about bull sharks. I mean, famously, people will always, when you talk about sharks, people always jump to Jaws, which was a great white. But as far as I think was the case, Peter Benchley, who wrote the book, based that on a series of shark attacks in fresh water that happened in New Jersey, I think in a little town called Matawan.
Yeah, I heard that too, yes.
So, you know, people, I think that 4 people died.
Yes, I heard that story before, yes.
So, I mean, that's one of those where somebody got taken, so somebody went in to rescue them and they got killed. So, I mean, that's, I think, 1916, something like that. But so it happens all over the place. Obviously, there are famous examples of floods washing them inland in Australia. And I know certain locations in Florida where they've had canals built around some of these new developments, Katie. I know people have seen sharks swimming around in them, which can only be bull sharks.
I mean, bull sharks are highly, highly aggressive. I mean, they're just, if not, maybe even more aggressive than great whites. I mean, they're around the same category as a great white.
Mm.
And, I mean, people just don't think of bull sharks. People don't think, you know, they'll think, I'm in fresh water and I'm safe. Well, surprise. I mean, down here, I've swam in the Crystal River, which goes out to the ocean. And I got thinking about it, and I'm like thinking, oh, God, I hope there's no saltwater crocs, because there are down here in Florida, more towards the southern end, you know, down the Keys, the Florida Keys and that sort of thing. You have the saltwater crocs. But it's amazing because, you know, being in the Crystal River, we went for a manatee swim, and the manatees are amazing. They're so gentle. And one of them went over and kind of hip-chucked Eric, my other half, hip-chucked him, like, get out of my way. I'm trying to take a breath of air. So he moved him out of the way. So that was quite comical. And, I mean, they're fascinating. And just, you know, going in that area, thinking about all the crazy stuff that can, because, I mean, dolphins can go in the Crystal River. They've been seeing the Crystal River, and bull sharks as well. So it's like, when you're out there, you're still on alert because you're like, I mean, the dolphins are amazing. I swim with dolphins too and work with their bioacoustic sounds and all that, and done recordings to help in my bioacoustics research with CHAMP. Sorry, I've got mush mouth at the moment. But, you know, the dolphins, obviously, I don't worry about. But then you get thinking, oh, there's probably a bull shark around here somewhere or something. You just, and even alligators in general, too. So you just never know what you're going to run into in Florida. There's a lot of crazy things down here. And, you know, you got sinkholes. There's like apartment buildings that have fallen in sinkholes and cars that have fallen in sinkholes. And matter of fact, down where I keep my horses, on the property here, we live on a lake called Lake Midget, which is kind of a funny name for a lake.
Very. Is it small? It is small.
And the funny thing is the neighbors have small ponies and they're like midget horses. So like it goes totally hand in hand. So it's a small little lake and it's spring fed. And down where the horses are, I was watering them the other day, and our water comes out of the lake, out of the spring, and we have a filtration system and stuff, but the water pH is perfect here. It's like better than most bottled water, so I don't mind drinking it. But we were down at the barn watering the horses, and I looked down the ground, and we get these things called pocket gophers, and they'll tunnel underground, and you never see the damn things. Like, they come out at night, and they got these really creepy looking teeth. Like, they got these huge teeth, and they're weird looking little creatures. But we had thought maybe it was a pocket gopher hole down where the horses are. And we just saw, we didn't see like a big pile of sand, but because usually you'll see a big pile of sand. There was just this huge hole in the ground. I'm like, where the heck does this go? So I thought maybe it was a snake, because we got a lot of snakes down here. So I took the hose and I put the hose down there. And I said, Eric, be careful on the other side. Something might come out of there. I don't know where this goes. And like, it just kept filling up. And I'm like, where the hell is this water going? And like, finally, it did come to the surface, and then it went down and disappeared. And I'm like, I don't know if I should be standing over here, because it could be a huge cavern that's going to cave in any minute. So luckily, the horses can't get to that spot. It's fenced in. That's where our potbelly pigs are. So I don't know what, maybe Champ was in there. Maybe they came down to visit and they tunneled themselves under out to Lake Midget. I don't know what that was, but
Wow. There
is a vast system of underground caves here with the limestone.
Yeah.
There's a lot of springs in Florida that I've done a little bit of diving in a couple of them, but they get down to like 150, 60 feet down. And a lot of these places, they don't want divers, because a lot of people have died trying to swim into these vents where the springs are coming out, and it's coming out so fast. The current is like really, really dangerous. So those are the places you want to stay away from. But I mean, there could be the same type of thing going on in the lake where there are tunnels going out to the St. Lawrence Seaway. I just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. To be honest, Katie, hearing a story about anything turning up in Florida does not surprise me anymore, because it seems to be America's zoo, both on land and into the water, because it just seems whatever creature gets released there seems to flourish. It's crazy what lives there now.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of invasive things here. I'm trying to remember what type of lizard. We were in an area called Jupiter, Florida, and I'm trying to remember what that lizard was. But there was a lizard that's from Africa that I happened to see up on a tree. And Eric said to me, he's like, oh, that's a such and such. I can't remember what the heck the name of it. It was like a rainbow colored lizard, like really, really like an orangey color on it.
Yeah.
And he had told me about it. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I've ever heard of one of those, but it was really, really cool. And they're kind of rare to see because they're not from here. I mean, there's not a huge population of them. We have gopher tortoises that are native to here. They're really cute. I just saw one this morning down when I was feeding the horses. There was a bunch of dirt flying up in the air, and I said, what the heck is that? And I look, and it was one of the tortoises digging a little hole. So, and they're protected. So one day we were driving, and one was in the middle of the road. So I got out, and I put them on the other side. And there was one guy I spoke to that was a local who I don't know. He was a local now, but I think he was from New York City, who's kind of a city boy. But he was like saying, oh, we found one of them tortoises. We thought it was a turtle, so we were trying to put it in the water. I'm like, what? What are you, crazy? You're going to drown the poor thing. Oh. So.
Bless, yeah.
Oh, God bless them.
Yeah, I remember seeing a couple of years ago, Katie, there was a because occasionally you'll see all kinds of strange videos from people in Florida. Usually dog walkers seem to encounter strange creatures, it seems. And there was a guy who ended up, him and his Labrador had a standoff with a tegu, which are those big black and white lizards, which I think are from South America. I'm trying to think of that lizard you've just mentioned. Oh, is it an agama?
You know what? Let me ask Eric real quick. Let me pop my head in the door. Hold on 1 second. I'll ask him because I can't remember it. I can't remember it at all.
Hey, how was that rainbow lizard thing looking thing you saw on the thing down in Jupiter?
Okay. It was a red-headed agama.
Ah, right. Yeah. They're called rainbow lizards, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, because that's what it looked like to me when I saw it. I said, oh, my God, what? That's really beautiful. I never seen one before.
Yeah. Well, you're not supposed to. They live in Africa, I think, don't they?
Yeah. That's why I was like, you just never know what. I mean, it would be really nice if Champ would come down here and just stay down here so I don't have to commute and stuff. Because like I was talking about earlier, I'm looking to buy a lakeside camp. Now, my house that's up near Lake Champlain, it's about 3 miles, so it's not, I can walk to the lake, and it's a great place. It's just, it's kind of the point where it's a really big place. It's 5.5 acres. It's a lot to take care of. Plus I have a ranch down here that's 5.5-6 acres. So it's like I'm bouncing back and forth, and I'm like, oh God. And of course with research comes, you need some funds to continue the research, buy the equipment. And I think with selling my property up there, I can purchase the lakeside camp that I'm looking at. And I'm actually looking to purchase a really large camper. I mean, this thing's like almost 40 feet long, so it's really big. And I don't feel like I'm in a sardine can. It's got LED lights. It's got a stereo system. It's really cool. So it'll be a really great champ camp for the lake. And that's my project. That's one thing I've been working on. And of course, you have to make phone calls to, you know, the town hall, the tax assessor, you know how it goes with real estate. There's a lot of paperwork and phone calls involved. So that's one of the things I've been doing lately that's been driving me crazy.
So I know you mentioned it earlier on, but why do you think they were so excited about this evidence you uncovered in September last year, Katie, in Germany? What do you think got them so excited? Because often, us here in the UK, we often look to the rest of Europe, and there doesn't seem to be this thirst for cryptozoology until you kind of start looking around, and then you see that there are people in France and Spain and Germany who are interested in these subjects. Did they kind of say any particular reason why they were so interested in this, or is this something that we're not really aware of, that they're really interested in strange creatures in Germany?
It's funny because I work with crews from Japan. They love cryptozoology. I mean, they're all into the lake monsters and sea monsters especially. So I worked with them a couple of times. I've worked with a Russian TV crew as well, but I've never worked with a TV company in Germany. So I was like really surprised. And the funny thing was, nobody ever got a hold of me to even put that on the news. Like, nobody emailed me, nobody called me. And I'm like, so I had like some people on my page that are in Germany, like they sent me a message, and then I have cousins in Germany that were like, hey, we just saw you on the news. And I'm like, what? I was totally unaware of like how I don't even know where the heck they got the info from. It was probably, maybe it was Coast to Coast AM, because that goes everywhere. Tim Binall, I'm friends with, and he had approached me about doing an article on it and that sort of thing. But I think the biggest thing about that sonar contact, it wasn't a still shot. It was a video and it was showing the motion. And I think that's so important. And that's why I got the military grade sonar. That was my goal, to get a video of one or two or whatever moving through the water and showing their locomotion. And even though it's a quick clip, you can see that there's an appendage moving back, pushing back. And then when you do the first still shot, it was funny because at first I'm like, that kind of looks like a sturgeon's head, you know, like, and then all of a sudden it changes more. It morphs where the neck stretches out, and then you see that horse like head. And I said, holy crap. So that was what was interesting about it, doing it frame by frame and seeing that appendage moving backwards. And what's really interesting, the beginning of that clip, which I don't know if I cut the very, very beginning of it. But what was interesting, in the background, there was something else going on. It might have been another one. I didn't include it, because sometimes less is more, you know, like I could have been like, hey, you know, that's another champ or whatever. I don't know what it was, but there was something behind that particular creature that we captured. So it could have been the second one. It was probably the two that I had gotten in 2019, because it was the same area as well. So I didn't want it to be too confusing for people and like, oh, well, she's just speculating. Yeah, I kind of am speculating with what I saw behind it, because I don't know what it was. So I think that's why they were interested, because it was showing the movement, the video. And I always hear people say, oh, wouldn't it be great if you had like a photograph of the head and neck? Well, here's the thing. In today's day and age, a photograph doesn't mean squat. Video sometimes doesn't, because there's so much CGI, unless you get that analyzed by like NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory or something to that effect. People are going to say it's fake. So to me, having a video of the creatures is more important than having a still shot, because it's showing the motion, and you can have that analyzed, and you know, by experts and all that, which all of my stuff has. It's just video is always better, because you can always take the still shots from the video.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose with that happening towards the end of your normal season up there, Katie, has that kind of changed what you're planning to do this year when you head back up there? Or are you going to continue doing what you're doing? Or have you got something up your sleeve? You're going to try something different? What have you got planned for this summer coming up?
Well, I kind of, how do I put this? It would be great to get another sonar reading, another sonar video, which would be really cool. I kind of do have a few experiments up my sleeve. I always have some crazy idea, but the biggest thing, you know, now that I've gotten echolocation, sonar video, and sonar video as well, the next step really for me, because I did work for that TV show for the CW network, and we did do a eDNA test. But what was really interesting about the eDNA test, number one, I think that the eDNA got degraded over time, because this was during COVID, and I explained to them they needed to put it through specialized filters and freeze what they had. And I don't know if they really did the protocol that they were supposed to, because they were going to send it to one lab I think it was UCLA in California. Something happened with the lab where they were closed because of COVID. So they waited like an extra, I mean, the show didn't come out till like a year and a half later. So it's like, it took all this time. And so finally they got the results back from this. I forget which lab it was. I'll have to look at the specific name, but they got the results back and they didn't find any otter DNA, any, waterfowl DNA, which is really weird. You know, you've got a lake, and where we went to get the samples was just a very small area. So we only took like two or three, I think it was three samples. So three samples out of a 120-mile long lake. I mean, you got to do a more extensive thing than that with samples. And then the lab said, well, if something didn't swim by in the last 2 weeks, you're not going to get it. That's nonsense. The test to me, it was either degraded DNA or their database was only so big. I think it was a cheap test is what I'm saying. I don't think they paid a lot to get it done. I think they just did a real simplified test. The one good thing that did come out of it was we did find that there is a pretty good population of muskellunge in Lake Champlain, which are stated as endangered. So that means the muskies are coming back, the population. Wow. So that's really good, especially with all the sewage stuff that's going on in the lake, you know. Yeah. That was a really pleasant surprise as far as the ecology being in a healthier state, which I didn't think it was. At least those fish are surviving and thriving. And then what was interesting was they didn't find any reptile or amphibian DNA, which an ectothermic animal, I think they're either or they're a weird hybrid of both, because evolutionary adaptation sometimes is funny.
Yeah.
You know, whales did start out with legs at one time and then they moved into the sea. So it's like, whoa, you know, you got to think of that weirdness about evolution. But since I didn't find any of those in the lake, I found that interesting, too, because there are frogs and turtles, you know, and you would think that it would show up in the DNA. So my goal for this summer or next summer, I may not get it done this summer, is to get some type of funding through maybe a program. I'm going to try to get a hold of like the Japanese because they really love this kind of study.
Mm.
And 93, they did a huge month long thing on CHAMP. I just saw an old VHS tape. And I was amazed. I mean, they had like 35 cameras set up. They had an RV with all these monitors. I mean, this was in 1993. They had a helicopter flying over. I mean, they were dead serious. I never seen so much serious research at one by any TV crew.
Wow.
You know, normally a TV crew will come in and be like, oh, we're going to spend a day. And that's about it. Like, that's as far as it goes, as far as real research to them. So, yeah, that's my goal, is to get some kind of further DNA test going. But, I mean, probably the best we're going to come up with if something comes through would be unknown reptile or unknown amphibian DNA. Because I believe whatever these animals are, they look very much like a plesiosaur. They also resemble a mosasaur. I just don't know what exactly they are, like a mix of both, or just I think they could have evolutionary adaptation coming into play where their midsection got longer, their neck got longer, that, you know, the who knows, but whatever they are, they're not in our known fossil record. So if they're out there, fossils are out there, they're deep down where no one's ever dug before. And that's just my opinion, especially with the glaciers cutting through at that time, when I think that's where they basically sprouted from, the ice age.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is often this thing. I mean, there was a very similar and quite controversial eDNA study done in Loch Ness recently. Yes. Katie.
Yeah.
And that didn't pick up species that everybody knows lives there. So I think sometimes people can put too much faith in something despite it being in its infancy as regards as an investigative tool that we can utilize, because the one at Loch Ness was notable because of the well-known creatures that didn't appear. And then they kind of explained it and said, well, it all depends on when we did it and where we did it and how that. And I was like, well, then what we've got here is a flawed test that people are putting forwards as compelling proof that something doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But it's telling us that creatures we know exist aren't there, but they're there. So
yeah.
What is the point at this point? It just seems like nonsense.
It's how dependable is it? You know, it's a fairly new study, and
yes,
that's the thing. So I am hoping with technology advancing that this eDNA test will be more dependable, that there'll be new types of testing in the testing that will reveal what known animals that are known to be in Loch Ness and Lake Champlain. That would be a big indication that the test is actually working, wouldn't you think? So
yes,
it's like, it's amazing. And so, yeah, I mean, if Nessie is the same as Champ, I mean, I think that the Champ animals are not in our known fossil record. So, I mean, there's nothing we could really compare the DNA to. unless, you know, they are a reptile or amphibian or something like that, you're going to get like, okay, there's reptile DNA, but we don't know what kind of reptile.
Mm.
So that would be like the best, I think, so far, unless we find a fossil, a tooth or a bone that DNA could be extracted from. That would be amazing. Or a body that washes up, which I think is never going to happen, but you never know. You never know. And I think if one does, I think the government would swoop down pretty quick on that. That's just my opinion, but who knows? I try not to get into the conspiracy theory stuff, but you know, I think that there is something kind of strange with the government too, because it's people are afraid of the unknown, and they probably don't want people to be freaking out, but they're animals. They're not monsters that are 100 feet long. They're eating people. I think if they were eating people, we have a lot of missing people on Loch Ness and Lake Champlain. So, you know, swimmers and stuff. I think we're more of a threat to them than they are to us.
Yeah.
And that's for sure.
Maybe they're afraid of men in Speedos, Katie. That might be the best way of keeping them away.
I kind of have a feeling that Champ and I have the same mindset. That's why I connect with him so well. So seeing poor Hans swimming across the lake in that god-awful Speedo, poor Champ is like, oh, my God, I'm going to go rest on the bottom and close my eyes. I just don't want to see that anymore.
Probably put them off their dinner, Katie, I would imagine.
Exactly. It's like, I don't think that they eat every single day, but now they probably don't eat for a year. So
on top of everything else, you've set up your International Drakontology Alliance. So what's this about, Katie, and what are you trying to achieve by organizing this?
Well, I wanted to, other than Champ Search, my organization that, you know, researches Champ and other elite creatures as well, I was looking to like get a group out there for people worldwide to join and base it on the conservation aspect, like we were talking about, of, you know, marine environments, and not just for the lake creatures, just marine environments in general. And yeah, and some protection for these creatures. Cause I mean, there's Lake Champlain, where I did write a law that was passed unanimously on the protection of the Champ animals, which I was really proud of and really surprised, because there was like a couple laws written in the 80s. But then I got thinking about it. I'm like, who's really going to follow a law that was from 1981? You know what I mean? I think these laws have to be updated, especially with the data. And what was interesting, that particular law was written by Joseph Zarzynski, who was a Champ researcher at the time, but he worded it kind of silly. You know, he said the Lake Champlain sea serpent, and he called it this like big monster. And like, it just didn't sound believable at all. It didn't sound coming from a scientific point.
Yeah.
So I did reword everything, and according to the data I've collected and all the eyewitness reports from people in the area, and that was all included. And it was a better presentation of a factual population of creatures rather than some mythical thing that's going on, which people would listen to it and say, what? This is stupid, you know? So I did reword it. And yeah, so that was really good. But my Drakontology Alliance is basically about that, the protection aspect of these creatures across the globe, and the scientific study, getting together with different ideas and, you know, maybe future expeditions. I was planning on going to Loch Ness in September. Things have been kind of a little rough getting things done, so I might postpone it until next June or something like that. You know, finances, busy stuff with trying to get my lakeside camp, which would be great because I'll have a lake view. And I only have to like go down the street a little bit to put my boat in, so that'll be even better. So I am planning on going to Loch Ness and doing some hydrophone recordings. I have an ROV, but you know, I don't think the ROV is going to be terribly useful in Loch Ness because of the clarity, the peak content.
Yeah.
I think the hydrophone stuff and the game cameras, where these animals have been seen going into some of the little bits of marsh system. There isn't like a huge marsh system on Loch Ness. There's like a little bit of wetlands going on where they've been seen crossing the road. You know, the Spicer account, the Arthur Grant account, he was on a motorcycle that saw a strange creature crossing the road at Loch Ness. So I'm going to check out those areas and stuff. And I'm going to be going with some of the members of the CFZ. If you want to go along, I haven't got a chance to talk to you about it. If you want to come with us, I think we're going to rent a van or maybe two vans. I don't know. Mm. But it's going to be a fun trip. And I think we're going to hit Loch Morar as well.
Looking for more, right?
Yes, which is really clear. And I think the ROV would work great in Loch Morar.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have got an open invitation to join them on an upcoming expedition. So that might be something good, because I've been fortunate enough to visit Loch Ness and go on it in a boat, Katie. So,
oh, super.
We were very fortunate. I think we'd need to choose the one day of the year it might be sunny in Scotland.
Yes. Oh, I know.
Going in the summer is no guarantee of the weather.
and we don't want to get attacked by midges either. Oh,
I used to think that was nonsense. And then the third day of my trip, I could hear a funny, like, banging noise on the hotel window. I was like, what the hell's that? You know, I'm next to a mountain. What on earth is it? And I opened the curtains and there's just all these midges, like a black ball of fury, just banging. And I was like, oh, God.
Oh, my gosh, that's crazy.
It wasn't a pleasant sight. And it was red hot as well that summer we were there. It was like the hottest it had ever been in Scotland. So I ended up sunbathing at Loch Ness, which is something not many people can say, I would suspect.
Yeah.
So yes, well, that's interesting. I'll have a word with Richard and see then.
Yeah, that would be great. And the other thing too, I think Richard had something planned for September anyway, because I was planning on like going September, but I think he's got something coming up, I forget which, and I'm probably not supposed to talk about it anyway.
Okay.
But I wanted Richard on board as well. So and then my friend Jackie Tonks was like, yes. We'll have to figure out when Richard's going on this thing. So I'm going to have to talk to her and a couple other people and just see what's good for everyone. And we'll figure a date out or whatever. And plus, my passport ran out like probably 10 years ago. So I need to update my passport.
Well, yeah. Jackie also lives on a houseboat, so she could probably sail there.
Yeah, exactly. And she's got a parrot, so she's like a pirate, you know?
Yeah, well, she's moved to Sheffield. She doesn't live far from me. She lives the other side of the city now.
Oh, okay.
Fabulous. Well, we'll keep that in mind. Well, fabulous.
Yes. Yeah, so, like, for the summer, probably my ultimate goal, it'd be nice to get the sonar video again, but the DNA stuff, maybe a head and neck video, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And maybe with my ROV to get them swimming up to the ROV and going, hi, you know, something like that. But that's really about it. I mean, that's all, in my opinion, that's all that is left for evidence. But then, even if Champ's proven to science, then it's a whole study on their breeding behavior. And, you know, it would be nice to, if we could lure them to the boat and tag them like they do with sharks.
Yeah.
And follow their, you know, their habits and see where they go in the wintertime to go in a torpor-like state. So it's going to be a whole, even if it's proven to science with that evidence all together, it's not going to be one piece of evidence. It's going to be all the stuff, including what I've gathered over the, you know, past decade. And so it's like you add everything like a big puzzle, all those pieces. And I think that's what's going to prove what's in Lake Champlain. It's not going to be just one thing. So that's the future. And hopefully we'll get some good evidence coming up. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think you've got to attack it from all angles, because eventually something's going to stick. So the more information you get across a number of disciplines, Katie, it can only strengthen the evidence, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, obviously, despite your summertime exploits hunting for lake creatures, I hear that you've spent your winter hunting for a more land-bound creature down in the hot and humid marshlands of Florida, as you've been doing some digging about looking for skunk apes, haven't you?
Yes, I decided to come down for the winters because I get really bad seasonal depression in Vermont and in New England. I mean, I grew up in Rhode Island, which isn't terribly far from Vermont, but it just got to the point where in the wintertime I had gone out in the ice looking, you know, underneath the ice for Champ, put the camera down, put the hydrophone down. And I've never really gotten anything in the last 10 years that I've been doing that. So I said, you know what? I can't stand this weather anymore. I got to go somewhere warm. So now I have a ranch down here that's about almost 6 acres, and I got my horses. They came down on the trip, and I'm actually going to leave them down here, and they'll be taken care of for 2 to 3 months while I go up to the lake and do my research this summer. I'm thinking of leaving like mid-June and probably stay until September, I would say. So, I mean, they'll be in good hands. I hate to do that, but it's such a pain to haul them back and forth. You know, it's, you get worried as a horse owner, you know, towing them on the highway puts a lot of stress on them traveling. So I'll be bringing my cats with me. So, because my one cat, Splash, he's very attached to me, and I can't leave him behind because he'd go crazy, and I would too. So yeah, that's the plan. And but while I've been down here, I've been doing a little bit of skunk ape research. I'm friends with David Shealy, who's done a lot of skunk ape research, and he's gotten video as well as prints, casted prints, amazing stuff. He's really dedicated. Mm-hmm. He's a good friend of mine, and we very similar in our mindset of the protection aspect as well, because he is big into the conservation of the Everglades and of the skunk ape species. And he had tried, I'm going to try to help him in this project at one point, to get a law passed for protection, but they wouldn't hear it. So I'm going to see if I can put a little bit of my experience on writing the champ protection law to help Dave out. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. send a nice letter to the governor. I think at the moment he'll be doing anything for publicity as he pushes his bid for the presidency down there in the upcoming elections, no doubt. So I mean, the skunk ape is something that's always intrigued me, and obviously I'm very aware of Dave. He seems to be one of those diligent researchers who just carries on doing what he needs to do, who's fully invested in the search for this creature.
Yeah, he absolutely is. And, you know, I mean, he's been on TV a lot too, as well as I have, but it's with him, he's got the same mindset as me. Like, he's not out to like, hey, I just want to be on TV. Like, he's about the protection aspects. And matter of fact, he just came out with a lager beer called Skunk Ape Research Headquarters Lager, and I did a commercial for it, and it's on YouTube if anybody wants to look it up. It's kind of like a comedy of a commercial where I'm out in the woods, and all of a sudden I see the skunk ape, and I scream because I'm looking through my binoculars, and then the skunk ape, aka my other half Eric, he's dressed as the skunk ape, he's sitting in a lawn chair drinking the skunk ape research headquarters lager, and then he crushes the can and he says recycle, and he throws it in the recycling bin, and then my friend V McCrinnan, I don't know if you probably know,
yes,
V.
Yeah,
okay, he did the narration, and he's like, that's right, it's skunk research headquarters lager, and he did such a good southern drawl of an accent that it was classic. So I actually think I'm going to enter that into the 14 Film Festival as one of my projects. So the commercial will be going in that too. So
that's something else to add to your IMDb list, yes. Katie, isn't it?
So, I mean, there's a lot of projects coming up. I'm hoping to finish my documentary, work on the research and get some more evidence and DNA stuff. So there's a lot. There's a lot coming up, and I'm really looking forward to, you know, showing some of my production work and getting that going as well. So I think it'll be a really, once all my production stuff's out, it's going to be really great. And I work really hard and try to get all the scientific stuff in there rather than just storytelling and getting people's stories. You know, that's the thing. I mean, most of these documentaries that you see that come out online, it's just all storytelling. There's really no science behind it and that sort of thing, or the protection aspects for these creatures. So I think all of that together is going to make a really interesting string of documentaries that I'm working on.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, Katie, it's been a fabulous pleasure catching up with you as always, my friend. Where can everybody follow your work online, join the Draconology Alliance, and keep up to date with everything that you've got going on, commercials for cryptid beer aside?
Okay, well, let's see. They can actually go to Facebook and type in International Draconology Alliance. It's DRACONtology, not G-O-N, not like a dragon, Draconology. So if they type in that, they can go to, there's actually a Facebook group and a page. And my email is on there as well if they want to join. There's a little commercial that's on YouTube for the International Draconology Alliance, which kind of explains our goal. And also you get a certificate, personalized certificate, a membership patch, and a membership card. And I'm going to be doing a subscription for our members through a digital newsletter every couple of months. And so if you go on Facebook and you type in the name of the group, it'll pop up. And then let me think what else. I got so many irons in the fire. My website is www.kittyelizabeth.org. And there's some info on there about my research, my tours, actually. I have tours on Kelpie, too, that I will be doing as well, which includes lunch and the whole basically a narrated tour of the history of Lake Champlain, as well as the sightings and using the equipment in the search for CHAMP. So that's another thing that's on my website. I'm trying to think what else. My commercial stuff is on YouTube. So if you type in CHAMP search, my YouTube channel will pop up. So you'll see the Skunk Ape, the Skunk Ape commercial on there. And I do plan on doing some more Skunk Ape research with Dave. I got to get down to his area, which is probably Homestead, Florida, is probably about, I think it's like 5 hours from me, 4 or 5 hours. It's quite a ways because we had stopped there to see him at one point going to Key West, which is like 6 hours. So he's a little bit of a ways away, but we plan on doing a little expedition down there with him. In the meantime, I've been doing a little bit of research up here near the Green Swamp where there's been a lot of reports of the Skunk Ape. I haven't found anything yet, but you never know. I mean, the only thing I did find was a slide from a very, very large python, which a friend of his looked at the track because we took like a dollar bill for scale because I didn't bring a measuring tape with me and use that for scale. And he estimated that that python slide, the animal is probably 14 to 15 feet long. So that's pretty scary. So we did find that. And there's really the python population. They talk about it in southern Florida. We're in central. But you never know. Like you said, that there's weird invasive stuff in Florida and it's just spreading around. So you never know what you'll find.
Yeah, they'll be slithering into Georgia before you can shake a stick at them, I would imagine, Katie. Most things tend to creep north. Well, as always, I'll put the links to all your bits and bats in the show notes. And I just want to say thank you again for coming back. Always lovely to catch up with you. I'm delighted you've continued to push the boundaries and keep getting more concrete evidence of strange things lurking in Lake Champlain. So thank you for joining me, Katie. You take care, and I look forward to your latest updates later this year.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was a pleasure being on again. Thanks so much.
We'll be right back.